People have been asking me as I've been preparing for this series, how are you going? You know, what is it all okay? And I said, well, I've been up to my eyeballs in sex, theoretically anyway, at least. Now, I should warn you at the outset, in case you're wondering, and I know a few of you are, that, you know, my main concern for this series is not going to be addressing questions related to LGBTQ stuff, but more so a broader question. What does it mean for us to be human beings and image bearers of God? And then what place does our sexuality have in that image bearing? I mean, especially when we speak of ourselves as Christ followers, what place does our sexuality have in our following of Jesus? So I'm not going to be addressing everything that's going on in our culture right now. Can't possibly do that in these short few weeks. But I do want to talk about how we're called to be the church in the midst of it. And I do think it has to be a church response, not an individual Christian response, because it, we'll get into that more next week, but it's going to take a whole church for us to think through how we are image-bearing Christ in the world, not just our own individual lives. But I do want to say at the outset, something Tim Keller said recently, that being gay won't send you to hell any more than being straight kind of gets you automatically into heaven, right? The only thing that can save us, the only thing that enables us to join in relationship with God is faith in Jesus Christ. It's his blood, it's his death and resurrection that draws us into God's family, that makes us part of what he's doing in the world, and that connects our lives to his. So I do think Jesus has a lot to say about how we live in the world, how we express our sexuality in the world, and a great deal of heat is being generated in the church over how we deal with the Bible. What does the Bible say? You know, what's the scripture say on these things? And we will deal with that. But this morning, it's not going to be a sermon. In fact, I'm kind of apologizing because I'm going to totally nerd out on you today. And this is going to feel a bit more like a lecture, like a seminar. But there's a reason for that. I mean, one, there's a lot of information to deal with, but there's also, I want to do this in a slightly detached way because emotions run high on this for a lot of people. And so I'm going to approach this as in a sort of detached way if I can. And next week, as we go further and further into this, over the coming weeks, then we'll get a bit closer to the issues where we'll probably have a bit more of a heart-gut response to the things that I'm going to say. Now, this morning, what we are going to do is survey the landscape a little bit, talk a bit about history, how we got here, how we got to where we are right now culturally, how things changed in terms of attitudes around sex and sexuality from really about 150 years ago to now. But it's particularly about 50 years ago, I think we could probably say with a pretty high degree of confidence that most people held a conviction around that there were certain kind of fundamental moral ideas related to sexuality. And Genesis 2 was sort of the draw-on text for this. You know, sex was seen as essential for sustaining marital intimacy, yes, but also for producing children. So marriage was exclusively between a man and a woman, which created a stable environment in which children could be raised, and that was for both the sake of the children and for the sake of society as a whole. Now, obviously, not everyone fit neatly into that picture, and it certainly didn't guarantee you a happy marriage. But there was a general belief that these realities were based on the kind of basic creational fabric of the world. They were God's design to ensure maximum human happiness and human flourishing. So Genesis 2, God creates Adam and Eve, male and female, joins them together in marriage and gives them the command to fill the earth and subdue it. In other words, have lots of babies and spread out and do things. Go and have fun. As Dale Cooney in his book Sex in the I World says, and I've got the slide here, until very recently, marriage and the extended family were the relational foundation of the world. They were so important and so constant that whether you lived 100 years ago or several thousand years ago, your identity and your life were rooted in a well-ordered relational structure. Your identity was inextricably connected to your nuclear family, your extended family, your local community, and your nation. And this network of relationships were believed to be essential to human flourishing and happiness. And this view that this relational structure is essential to human happiness, that goes as far back as Aristotle. I mean, from the Greeks, the Romans believed this. And it's not just a Jewish and a Christian idea. So this kind of set of beliefs framed our sexual practices, including the idea that we entered into marriage and had children not just for our own fulfillment and happiness, but also for the general benefit of the whole society. This was seen as something that was good for everybody, for the common good of all people. Now, as I said, it wasn't just a Christian or Jewish idea that marriage and family and children and sex and society are all inextricably linked. This has been central to most human societies throughout history. David Blakenhorn, in his book, The Future of Marriage, says, I think I've got this on the slide too, that the evidence that marriage as defined here is a universal human institution is overwhelming. In fact, especially in light of the vastness of the human historical record and the variety of human sexual experience, the power and prevalence of this one sexual institution across time and cultures is so noteworthy and so empirically incontrovertible. Man, that was hard to say at the 9 a.m. service. That I'm tempted to say all human societies. Now, in case you misunderstand me, I'm not here this morning to defend marriage. That's not what I'm doing. But my point is that something happened around the middle of the last century, or the 1960s, that has radically changed the moral landscape in terms of sex, sexuality, human relationships, marriage, how we think about the meaning of our human relationships. Since the sexual revolution that started in the early 60s, the relational world we inhabit has been turned completely on its head. And that's not even an understatement. That it's been completely turned on its head. So that you could be living, 100 years ago, and you would have no idea what was coming. The point being, as the previous quote from Dale Cooney says, in the last, from thousands of years up until around about 1960, there was a fairly stable set of ideas around what marriage, family, sex, human relationships were all about. Suddenly, in the last 50 years, that's all completely changed. Long before the swinging 60s, several things were going on in the previous 100 years prior to that that led up to it. So the sexual revolution just didn't come out of nowhere. There was a whole set of things going on that kind of led up to it. And one of the most important was the publication of Darwin's The Origin of the Species in 1859. With kind of Darwinism, evolutionary theory now starting to become pretty much considered the way that we describe the universe, the world and everything, then the authority of the church and the authority of the Christian story, especially the creation story, and the authority of the Bible, were now being seriously questioned and challenged and displaced. I think it was the German... So I told you I was going to nerd out on you this morning. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who was a contemporary of Charles Darwin and who had a massive impact on philosophical thinking, saw what was going on most clearly at the time. And he said, God is dead. God remains dead and we have killed him. How should we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe the blood off us? What water is there to cleanse ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? So unless you mistake what he's saying, he's saying that this death of God is a good thing. Now that God is dead, human beings are finally free to become our own gods. We're finally free from the shackles of repressive and arbitrary Christian morality. So Nietzsche understood that in a godless world, there's no longer any kind of moral foundation for human behavior. There's no meaning. The universe doesn't care about us. So what we have to do is rise to the challenge and create our own meaning by sheer force of the will. This is the will to power. We have to gather our resources and create our own meaning. The only other option is despair, which leads to suicide. And you can see the existentialists in the 40s, 50s, and 60s came right out of kind of Nietzschean thinking. So we can't base our lives on any higher meaning or value. We simply have to take the world as it is, and we touch the void, and we find that there's no meaning there. And so then we have to create our own. Richard Dawkins, whom you probably all have heard of, writes this: in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, Some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, or any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect, if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. So there's no longer any transcendence, there's no higher purpose to which we're called or called to pursue. We make our own meaning. Now, I don't think that actually the evolutionary theory on its own leads you to those conclusions. I think there's a way of thinking about evolution from a Christian point of view that doesn't deny the science, but at the same time doesn't lead you into nihilism, into nothing. So I don't think actually that this is the only option we have. Nevertheless, this is pretty much the popular opinion. The contemporary theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss describes this in this video. It's only about a minute long. Just check it out.
The picture that science presents to us is in some sense uncomfortable, because what we've learned is that we are more insignificant than we ever could have imagined. You could get rid of us and all the galaxies and everything we see in the universe, and it'll be largely the same. So we're insignificant on a scale that Copernicus never would have imagined. And in addition, it turns out the future is miserable. So the two lessons that I like to say I like to give is, first, we're insignificant, and second, the future is miserable. Now, that you might think that should depress you, but I would argue that, in fact, it should embolden you and provide you a different kind of consolation. Because if the universe doesn't care about us, and if we're an accident in a remote corner of the universe, in some sense it makes us more precious. The meaning in our lives is provided by us. We provide our own meaning. And we are here by accidents of evolution and the formation of planets, and we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. We should make the most of our brief moment in the sun, because this is all we have. And even if we're so rare that we're the only life forms in the universe, which I doubt, that makes us, in some sense, while we're more insignificant, we're more special. We are endowed with a consciousness that can ask questions about the beginning of the universe and learn about the universe on its largest scales and experience everything that it means to be human: music, art, literature, and science. So for me, it should be spiritually uplifting that we're not created with a purpose by someone who takes care of us like a mannequin or with strings determining everything. We determine our future, and that makes our future more precious.
We determine our future: music, art, literature, and science, and sex. Right? You're all thinking this was meant to be a talk on sex. Why are we talking about science? Point I'm trying to make here is that if this is true, if what Lawrence Krauss, Darwin, and Dawkins, and Nietzsche said is all true, that we must determine for ourselves what we'll become, this then includes the way we think about the meaning of our relationships, our sexuality, and our sexual practices. Now, add to this the growing influence in the late 19th century of Sigmund Freud, who is teaching that repressing our sexual desire is unhealthy, possibly even dangerous, and seeking sexual fulfillment is an important cure to a whole host of kind of mental and emotional conditions. And then in the 20th century, then, relationships and sex are now beginning to be thought of as something to pursue for their own sake, not for the greater good of marriage and family and society, but for your own fulfillment, your own happiness, to deal with your own emotional problems. So in other words, the kind of biblical framework was in the process of being rejected as meaningful any longer for Western culture. So in this new era of personal freedom, people are rejecting higher authorities, Bible, church, God, family, parents, all that, that once helped them make sense of their identities. And now what's happening is they're beginning to look within themselves to sort of find their true selves, their true identity. We're looking inward to discover who we really are. And so true personal freedom and authenticity as a human being are about discovering your inner sense of self and then living in harmony with the desires that you find there. And so this is kind of framed as being true to yourself, being true to yourself. Whereas once we would have said, you need to be true to your obligations, you need to be true to the scriptures, you need to be true to God, you need to be true to your family. Now we're saying the primary thing, the most important thing in life, above everything else, is that you are being true to yourself. Okay? That's a massive shift. And really, much of what develops in terms of sexuality from that point is what turns on that moment. The shift from looking for our sense of identity from outside of ourselves to now very much looking for our identity within ourselves. Now, this is all still kind of marginal. It's not gone mainstream yet. What happens between 1939 and 1945 changes everything. Of course, that's the Second World War. And I saw this in my own family. People came back from the war, and they could no longer believe in God. They just couldn't believe in God in a world where there was the Holocaust and gas chambers and concentration camps and nuclear weapons that could wipe out millions in a moment, and 80 million people dead in 4 years on battlefields in Europe and North Africa and Asia. People just lost faith in God. It was just no longer plausible to believe in God. So the churches began to empty out. People didn't go to church anymore. They still sent their children, ironically, for a moral education. But there was no faith underneath it. Now it had just shifted from faith in God to kind of moral education, ethics. And of course, Nietzsche's right. Once you take the faith component, well, the ethics no longer make any sense. The morals no longer make any sense. So, of course, the children of the war generation, the baby boomers, grew up, going to Sunday school and just learning the morals. And when they became adults, they rejected the morals because they don't have the faith that those morals are built on, those ethics are built on. So while there's a kind of rejection of Christianity going on in the 40s and late mid-40s and later, there's actually a kind of new excitement about the future emerging in this new modern scientific worldview. Everyone's excited about progress and about where we're headed. This is the era of space exploration and computers and television and passenger planes and new medical technology that can do things that we would never have possibly imagined medicine could do. So there's all this excitement about the future, but it's actually based on a kind of godless universe, a belief in Big Bang evolution, a bright future of human progress that we're going to build for ourselves with scientific advancement and technology. We no longer need God because we're going to fix our own problems. See what God did? See what belief in God did? It killed 80 million people in 4 years. That's what belief in God does. It kills people. Religion is dangerous. I mean, Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, they're just feeding right out of that worldview that religion poisons everything. So what we need to do is reject religion, and what we're left over with is kind of a hopeful future, even though it's in the end meaningless, just like Lawrence Krauss says. So by the time the children of the war generation, the baby boomers, came of age, they were rejecting the moral and ethical foundations of Christianity, and then they were rejecting the morals and ethics of Christianity as well. So what Friedrich Nietzsche predicted 100 years earlier, if God's dead and actually never really existed, then we can and should dismantle the ethical worldview of Christianity and recreate the future in our own image. And that's pretty much what people did. 1965, this cover was published. Time magazine, one of the most famous magazine covers of all time. It captures the spirit of the age perfectly. 1965, is God dead? That's what everyone's asking. Which is just because the answer is he never really existed. And then you combine that with another little piece of technology that emerged in the 1960s. Which was, of course, the pill. And suddenly we've got a perfect situation in which unbridled sexual freedom can begin to be expressed. See, if sex no longer leads to babies, thanks to the pill, then we're now free to experience a revolution in our sexual expression and sexual personal freedom. And so the sexual revolution got underway. And there are four elements to it. Here's this next slide, four elements to the sexual revolution. Sex is good in and of itself. There was a new ideal that men and women should come together in sex as equal partners, free of restrictive gender roles. 3, sex is a liberation from repressive authority, and sexuality is a core part of our individual identity. Okay, so let's just pause for a minute and think about this, because we take a lot of this as given in terms of this is just kind of the air we breathe now. But we are the first culture on the face of this earth throughout all of human history that has believed these things. Now, I'm not saying that they're right or wrong or anything at this point. I'm just saying that we are the first culture in human history to have ever believed these four things, ever. And it all happened in 50 years. Well, I mean, as I said, there's a lead up to it. There's a story, Nietzsche, Freud, Darwin. But then suddenly, in the 1960s onwards, we've gone from a culture where people are expressing their sexual freedom for the first time to now these four tenets are kind of the core of what we think about in terms of sex and sexuality in our culture. So in other words, in 50 years, the sexual revolution's gone mainstream. But it hasn't been without consequences. And one of those consequences, ironically, is that with this, all this new emphasis on the authentic self and liberated sexuality has placed actually immense strain on our relationships. And Johnny Grant, in his book Divine Sex, and Johnny was actually a part of our church for a few years, he wrote this: living in an age of authenticity has placed heavy burdens on intimate relationships and left couples striving to build security and meaning on its hopelessly weak foundations. Because of our culture's move away from transcendence or a belief in God as the source of reality, we've now come to place the full weight of our personal identity on ordinary life, on the material here and now existence. Rather than becoming free and expansive, our relationships have in fact become narrow and constrained, having no purpose beyond themselves. This exclusive focus has seismically destabilized them in two ways. One, the burden they bear becomes overwhelming because of the expectation that all of our psychological, emotional, material, and sexual needs will be met by one remarkable soulmate, right? And we'll talk about that some more next week, specifically. But number two, the very bond we crave is actually undermined by the inwardly focused nature of the authentic self, because we do not so much give ourselves to a relationship anymore as expect the relationship will give to us. So even though the belief was that, you know, our liberated sexuality is going to lead to freedom and happiness, it's actually led to a lot of pain and confusion around why our relationships don't work the way that we expect them to. So there's a growing recognition that the sexualization of our culture and our relationships might not be making us as free and as happy as we thought it would. Now, whether or not that's actually the case, the point is that where sex was once embedded in a network of other relationships and obligations that gave it its meaning, so family, children, society, God, etc., the new world of authenticity and self-determination is now, as the highest good that we can aspire to, has reduced our sexual ethics to essentially kind of three taboos. You'll probably be familiar with these. Next slide. One may not criticize someone's life choices or behavior. I was just talking to someone after the first service who said that they work in an environment where they get together in groups where they have to out loud affirm a set of sexual beliefs that this particular person doesn't actually believe. But they're not allowed to not believe them. Because if she actually said, I don't believe this set of sexual ethics that we all have to say out loud, like we're in church, I would lose my job. Right? So you're not allowed anymore to criticize someone else's choices or behavior. Two, one may not behave in a manner that coerces or causes harm to others, unless you don't believe the right things. Three, one may not engage in a sexual relationship with someone without his or her consent. So obviously, in a sense, the only two things that are now off limits sexually are rape and pedophilia in our culture. There's pretty much nothing else that's off limits anymore. Because it's about consent. As long as we're all consenting, everything's cool. How did we get here? What happened between 1960 and 2016? Everyone take a big deep breath. Okay. There's been five stages of transformation or separation from 1960 to 2016. And they haven't all necessarily occurred simultaneously, like, you know, one after the other. Some of them, there's blurry lines here, but there are kind of five steps or five stages of separation of sex from its old framework that I want to just quickly walk us through. The first step, which was the first one in 1960, was the separation of sex from procreation. So with the introduction of the pill, just as the sexual revolution got started, in fact, without it, it wouldn't have been possible. The sexual revolution just would not have been possible without the pill. Because for the first time in history, sex was no longer directly connected to babies. Like every other era in history, if you had sex, you had a baby, pretty much. And so because you were going to have a baby, if you had sex, then you needed marriage around it to make sure that that child was cared for and loved. Like, sex created obligations. But once you introduce the pill, once you introduce this technology, sex no longer has obligations, or at least we don't think it does. The implications that this has had for marriage and for our understanding of relationships in general are huge. Or as Bernie Sanders would say, huge. They're huge. It's only because of contraception that we can even think about sex as being primarily about physical pleasure and mutual gratification. It's only because of contraception that we can even think about sex in that framework. And it's only because of this that sex has then been reimagined as a private act, just as Trudeau said in the 70s, that the government should have no involvement in what people do in their bedrooms because sex is private. It has no social, personal, or religious implications. So children have now become, in this particular worldview, this particular separation, children have become now a lifestyle choice. You have children when you feel ready to have children, right? You choose to have children. And I actually think that that has completely changed the whole way we think about raising children. It's had massive implications for us. You see it everywhere. Like, children are kind of marketed now to us culturally as this lifestyle choice that helps you truly express your personal sense of self. I mean, what are we actually imposing on children when we take that view? In any case, Sarah Williams from Regent College, and these steps, by the way, I'm drawing from her and also from Johnny. He uses the same framework in his book. Sarah Williams says, there's no question that the procreative consequences of sexual union in past ages were a vital part of the sexual monopoly of marriage. Children have become an aspect of union that is now subject to the autonomy of individual choice, aside from the meaning of sexual union as an act of human production written into the created order. And this is what Pope John Paul II said, in fact, and he opposed the pill quite vocally. But he was saying that once you do this, once you separate sex from procreation, what's going to happen is that you're going to divorce sex from its creational framework, from its creational meaning, and it's going to lose its potency. It's going to lose what it actually has been intended for us by God. Now, whether or not whatever your views may be on procreation, at this point I don't care. I'm just saying that this has been one of the most significant steps in moving us from the 60s and onwards. Step two, then, is a separation of sex from marriage. So if you know, if children are not the consequences of sex, well, then you don't really need marriage anymore. So premarital sex, cohabitation, have now become seen by many people as simply a sensible form of pre-marriage testing. You know, you find out whether you're compatible sexually with one another, and if things are working out, then maybe you'll get married, maybe you won't. It's an alternative lifestyle. The loosening of sexual relationships is actually reflected in this growing use of the term partner or spouse. But partner in particular, which is actually an economic term. People refer to their significant other as their partner. Well, that's a business term. And so what that means, but that actually has an interesting impact, where it comes from an interesting source, because what's happened is that whereas once marriage was thought of as primarily covenantal, as a promise that you make, an unbreakable vow that you make with someone, now marriage is a contract. And so now we use business terms to describe the meaning of marriage. So it's a contractual partnership. And so the story kind of goes something like this. In the name of authenticity and honesty, we declare that we will be partners in this common relationship for as long as it suits our perceived needs and desires. As long as we still love each other and it's mutually beneficial, we'll remain together. But if the partnership no longer works, we'll dissolve the relationship in order to pursue or maximize our happiness elsewhere. And this is now seen as kind of true faithfulness, because we're not faithful anymore to the promises we've made necessarily. What we're being faithful to is ourselves. I'm being faithful to my sense of self. I'm being true to myself. Anyone here read Eat, Pray, Love? I mean, that's the thesis of the whole book. This woman's in search of herself, and she's being true to herself as she tries to find out what love is all about, leaving her husband behind her. Step three, separation of sex from partnership or long-term relationships at all. So then we have, you know, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that once you take marriage out of the picture and it becomes about partnership, well, then you don't even really need partnership or long-term relationship at all. Hookup culture, one-night stands, friends with benefits. You know, most people now just consider sex a kind of rite of passage, a necessary path that may or may not lead to the establishment of a relationship or intimacy in the long term. Or maybe even just a supplement along the way. You know, you're supplementing your loneliness by having sex with people. So sex now often becomes before intimacy and commitment in any kind of relationship. Sex may be given in the hope of a long-term relationship, but that's rarely the expected outcome anymore. I mean, I talk to people all the time about what it's like in the dating scene in Vancouver. You know, and there's a lot of sex being had, but not very many long-term relationships being formed. And Johnny Grant says in his book that the commodification of sex as a form of recreational pleasure-seeking means that many people have come to think of sex as a pursuit that just happens to involve another person. So it's just sex, right? Try to have as much of it as possible with whoever's up for it. There's no commitment involved. It's not love. Sex is commodified in the sense that it's become something to have. It's been something to consume just alongside anything else that you might like to consume. Step four, then, is separation of sex from another person. You know, as the reasoning goes, why include other people if sex is purely about self-gratification? Why have sex with other people at all if you can have sex with yourself? The rise of pornography, especially online pornography, has created a kind of perfect storm here. Recent studies have shown that many men and a growing number of women actually prefer pornography to sex with a real person because it's easier, it's less complicated, it's on tap whenever you want it, and there's a whole range of stuff out there that you can enjoy, whatever takes your fancy. And more teenagers are getting their sex education from hardcore porn. Step five then becomes the separation of sex from our own bodies. So this is the final form of separation, which is the inevitable result of this journey, the other four steps. Our inherited gender was once seen as normative for determining what form of sex we engaged in and with whom. Right? But it's become a core modern intuition that gender and sexuality are things we choose, or if we don't choose them, that our orientation is part of a deeper kind of sexual personality that transcends our biological gender. So in the last 10 years especially, we've seen massive cultural change concerning homosexuality, legalization of same-sex marriage in the USA, acceptance of transgender persons, you know, just the vast possibilities that we're presented with in terms of sexual options and experiences. Like the last 10 years, it's just been an explosion. Vanity Fair said last year that 2015 was the gay lesbian moment. 2016, they predicted, will be the trans moment. You know, and of course, Caitlyn Jenner is the most famous, most recent poster girl. And by the way, this has probably gone further than you may realize. The Vancouver School Board and the Alberta Education Ministry have already instituted policies that force schools and teachers to accept without question the gender that a student believes themselves to be, irrespective of their biology. And the schools are not required, in fact, are not allowed to tell the parents this in case the parents might be transphobic and intervene and recommend therapy. So the schools are not allowed now to tell the parents if a child in the classroom says, I believe I'm a different gender to the one that I present. And the schools have to accommodate that. It's considered transphobic to recommend any kind of counseling or therapy of any kind. And that's the world we're in now. For thousands of years, all of this would have been unthinkable, but in the last 50 years, it's become the culture that we live in. Here's Johnny Grant says that cut free from the moorings of divine design, the stunning transformation has been accepted as self-evident within the modern moral paradigm, and yet such a perspective has been made possible only by the progressive stages of separation outlined above. Today, despite the unambiguous testimonies of our bodies, we are faced with a seemingly infinite array of sexual choice. We've been left without a foundation on which to think about how to engage our sexuality, except for open-ended self-expression, which fuels the confusion and destructive dynamics of modern sexual practices. The loss of any coherent cosmic structure that gives sex its real purpose, namely God's blessing of sex within marriage for intimacy and childbearing, leads to sexual chaos. Now, obviously, people have been having sex in all kinds of ways and with all kinds of people throughout history. Like, none of this is new as such. The point that I'm making is that in 50 years or so, our culture has so fundamentally changed on a massive scale around this. In 50 years. Now, you may not agree that it's leading us to relational and sexual chaos, but I do think that there have been significant social consequences of the emergence of this new kind of I world, this individualistic world, where sex is redefined around the individual and the needs of the individual. My question, I suppose, is how has this enhanced our happiness and led to human flourishing in Western societies? Now, I just want you to consider for a moment what's going on. There's that story. There's also another story. And that other story looks like this, that never before has divorce been so easy to obtain and so widespread. All you have to do these days is list irreconcilable differences and you can get yourself a divorce. You know, prior to no-fault divorce, it was almost impossible to break up a marriage. But now no-fault divorce is the norm. And this has led to massive family breakdown. Almost half of marriages now end in divorce. And children are caught between parents who don't love each other anymore and in some cases hate each other. And are locked between parents who are in bitter feuds over the future of the family. Never before have adults and children had to deal with this on such a large scale. And I wonder, my question is, what has this done to our belief in relationship, in our capacity to trust other people? What has this done to the fabric of our society, our trust in love even? Never before have we seen abortions performed on such a massive scale. Despite easy access to contraception, some 58 million children have been aborted in the USA since Roe versus Wade. 58 million. Never before in history, ironically, have we had such low fertility rates as we do in the Western world. Western countries now almost exclusively rely on immigration to keep our population levels above replacement. We aren't having, our own cultures aren't having enough babies to survive, in other words. We're relying on the cultures that don't believe these things to prop up our populations. Never before have we seen such high rates of children born outside of marriage and being raised by single parents. And they're usually women, and they are often overwhelmingly poor. 50% of the single mothers in our culture right now live below the poverty line. 50% who are raising children on their own. Where are the fathers? Children, boys especially, growing up without a father or an absentee father are more likely to drop out of school and end up in jail than in any other single group. Never before have we seen such high rates of premarital sex and cohabitation. And cohabitation, as we said before, is now believed to be kind of the natural and normal precursor to marriage, even though statistically, people who live together before marriage are more likely to get a divorce. But that, you know, that kind of goes against the narrative we usually hear. And with all the relational and sexual choice we have, people are often feel very paralyzed by the options and can't settle down with one person. Because why settle down with one person when there's so many other people out there, then one of them might be better. And so we're kind of living in this tyranny of choice where we're always thinking, is this person going to be better for me? Is that person going to be better for me? Am I going to be more happy with them? Or what about that person? Maybe I'll be more happy with them. And I actually believe that there is no such thing as your soulmate. There's no one out there who's going to complete you. Often we say this in church that, you know, a man and a woman are like 50% of a whole person. You put them together and it makes them complete. That's just complete BS. Adam and Eve, if you're going to take that story, were not half humans that needed another person to complete them. They were persons made in the image of God. And what we do when we join in marriage and join in relationship is offer ourselves wholly to the other. And the pursuit, I guess, in marriage is not to find your soulmate, but to make yourself the right soulmate for the person that you're with. So people are just finding it very, very hard to navigate this new sexual landscape. With the rise of pornography, men especially now have completely unrealistic expectations of what sex will mean and what it will involve. Sex with a real person is often a very disappointing and dysfunctional experience. And this is a story being told over and over again. I thought sex would be far greater than it actually turned out to be. The expectations that pornography created for me just have not lived up to reality. I think this has all brought an immense amount of pain for us. A lot of pain, a lot of relational hurt, a lot of mistrust now in people, and a huge amount of hurt. I talk to people all the time just carrying so much relational hurt around with them. And it flows often from what their what happened to their parents, what they've experienced with other people. And I think there's a cry going on in our culture right now where people are just desperate to try to figure out how to be in relationship with one another, but they just don't know how to anymore. I think that our sexual liberation has led to less relational happiness, not more, overall. As a result, and I think this to me is the most telling statistic of all. As a result of what's happened since the 1960s, never before have people been so lonely and so alone. Eric Klinenberg, in his excellent book, Going Solo, shows that for the first time ever in human history, living alone is the predominant residential pattern in the Western world. More people live alone now than in families. And that's very painful for people. They didn't necessarily choose it, but that's the situation they find themselves in. The church hasn't been immune to these changes. Christians have been challenged and affected by all of these shifts. In fact, some of the best research out there shows that Christians are not substantially different on the wider culture than this. Really quickly, last thing, what's the script that people are generally now living by, including many Christians? Here it is, long-term, next slide, long-term exclusivity in relationships is not possible. It may even be unnatural. The introduction of sex is necessary to help a struggling relationship. It doesn't matter what other people do sexually so long as you're free to make your own decisions. Pornography is harmless and won't affect your relationships. Everyone else is probably having more sex than you are. There's a lot of anxiety around that. Sex is harmless, fun, and doesn't need to mean anything more than that. And moving in together is a definitive and positive step toward marriage, or perhaps you might say a definitive and positive step toward a long-term relationship. So is this our story? Is this our sexual script? Now, I want to finish with this. There's one verse in Scripture which I think calls into question many of the ways that we in our culture, or we as Christians in our culture, have been affected by all this. Because I think that for a lot of Christians, perhaps without really thinking about it, have adopted maybe not the sexual ethics per se, but have certainly adopted the kind of cultural attitude that underlies them, that the most important thing in your life is to kind of find your own inner self and live the most fully authentic life that you possibly can in terms of who you really are on the inside. You see, the thing is that what that does is it says that the primary script that we're following, the primary text that we base our lives on, is our own inner sense of self. Whereas Christians for the rest of history have said the primary text that we base our lives on is this, is the Scriptures, and in particular, the life and the ethics of Jesus. And this is what Paul says in Colossians 3. I think I've got it on the screen. Colossians 3. And so he's talking to Christians now, right? Since then, you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ who is your life, when Christ who is your life appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. What Paul is saying is that the place from which we draw our identity, the place from which we understand who we truly are, the place where we understand our true inner self, if you like, is not by looking inward. In fact, ironically, throughout history, Christian theologians have often defined sin as a looking inward, a turning inward. What Paul says is if we want to become our true selves, if we want to find our true identity, if we want to become the people that we've been created in Christ to be, we have to look to him and base our life on him and on his teaching and on his way. We are following the way of Jesus, not reinterpreting the way of Jesus through our own lens of our own personal experiences and emotions and feelings. Our sense of inner self often becomes the primary text, and then the Bible and the life of Jesus has to be reinterpreted in the light of that. And what Paul is saying is, no, you've got to flip that around the other way. It's the Bible that reads you. It's not you that reads the Bible, as it were. It's Jesus who determines who you are, not you determining who you'll be as you follow Jesus. He judges us. He calls us. He names us, not we ourselves. And now this is a big challenge, because this runs totally counter to everything we're hearing from our culture. But after all, being a Christian means being countercultural. And so that's what we're called to. Now, we'll talk much, much more about all these things in the coming weeks, but I just wanted to kind of lay that out, map out the landscape a little bit, and then invite you to think for a moment this morning about where you're drawing your identity from. Is it what's going on around you? Is it how you feel on the inside? Or is it as you look to Christ, who is your life, then your true self is beginning to appear? Thank you.